these are poems that I'm learning to read. And part of the reason I think part of my motivation for trying to generate some excitement around historical poetics in Australia and think alongside poet friends and colleagues is so that I may feel justified in spending a lot of time staring at material like this. What we are looking at is three ballads in Jamaican Creole, what then would have been called dialect, written between 1911 and 1913. I'm not going to go through these poems. I'm going to talk about a different poem. But what I'm trying to do and what this paper is about is how does one attune one's ear to be able to think with the poetics of these Creole ballads, material that is basically been not forgotten because it was never really known about in the first place, and which presents a lot of tricky problems despite seeming to be extremely simple poetically. The three authors are, one is the young Claude McKay, who I'll be talking about today. In the middle is Raglan Phillips, a reverend who liked to pen the odd ditty, I guess, in dialect. And on the right is Thomas McDermott, a.k.a. Tom Redcam, the first poet laureate of Jamaica, proclaimed by an Imperial Jamaican League. So I'm not actually going to match that. The three faces don't match with the three poems. And in a different version of this paper, I sort of went through and slowly matched the faces to the poem. But in a sense, I'm trying to think through the from the material to the history, not in a sense the other way round. And just something that I think bears keeping in mind is that most appearances of Creole verse in print in this period will be Creole verse written by white men, in a sense, adopting a black peasant voice. Just another thing that bears remembering is that this is a print reality. These are verses published in the papers, the Gleaner and the Jamaica Times. And this is the evidence of the oral reality of Creole ballads in the interior of Jamaica. This is something collected by an American musicologist, ethnomusicologist Martha Beckwith in the 1910s. And here we have a classic English ballad that date back, I think, is known to date back to the 17th century. That's said from memory, don't quote me on that. And she went and she collected creolized ballads in the interior and recorded them. And hopefully at some point the powers that be will give me some money to get to the Library of Congress to be able to listen to some of these recordings. So just be aware that this isn't the only verse tradition we're talking about, where there's an appearance in print that's dominated by white a kind of white minstrelsy, and then there's a sort of rural tradition of balladry. And in a way, Claude McKay, the figure at the centre of this paper, is a convergence of those two things. So I'm going to put that in the background while I start my paper. So in 1913 and 1915, two debates flared up in Jamaica's newspaper of record, The Gleaner, over the legitimacy of Jamaican Creole as a verse medium. The first concerned the use of, as a literary medium. The first concerned the use of Creole in verse and was prompted chiefly by Claude McKay's widely celebrated volume, Song of Jamaica and Constable Ballads. The second, its use in prose fiction and non-fiction, and was prompted chiefly by the appearance of Pepper Pot, a volume which carried the byline, Some Sketches by the Wayside of Jamaican Life. So we're dealing with two controversies that arose from the appearance of Creole in print. And it was the printing of Creole that produced a controversy where balladry on the one hand and sketches on the other had been quite present in Jamaican culture in this period, but it was the movement into print that produced these controversies. I'm not interested in what these controversies can tell us about the status of Creole as a language, but the ways in which they registered the expectations concerning poetic technique and genre for early Creole verse. That is, I'm interested in these debates as a portal into the poetic thinking demanded by the materials to hand at this time. That is, not as a set of discourses which reflect the status of Creole verse as a cultural practice, let's say. This is not to sideline broader historical questions about the racialized environment that were the precondition for these debates. To the contrary, it shows us how poetic thinking itself worked at the limits of the racialization of experience. At this point in the history of Creole verse, the debates and the verse are quite mannered, and the normativity of colonial social relations seemingly are unquestioned. Yet the movement of verse technique as the linguistic raw materials of creolized African English encountered a set of expectations engendered by verse in standard English and British varieties forms part of a longer story of an emergent poetics, emergent in the sense of Raymond Williams, one that will later be associated with the term decolonization. From the perspective of a consciousness that has access to the rich field of Creole linguistics and the confidence of a broad and variously articulated post-colonial critique, these debates are notable for their condescension and seeming total ignorance of the African dimension of Jamaican Creole. Seen in retrospect, it is clear that a language that behaves intonationally like a syllable-timed West African language was being judged according to standards and criteria upheld for the poetics of stress time, standard English. I'm speaking in generalities here. Nevertheless, such misrecognition should not be dismissed as though the true Creole being of this verse now can be recognized. Such misrecognitions are a part of the texture of the poetic thinking at this time. A thoroughgoing historical poetics calls on us to imagine a world in which the ethical and political paradigm shifts brought about by decolonization were yet hardly imaginable. We cannot anachronistically scold you fools. You're not dealing with a dialect or broken English. This is a different language with its own logic and set of possibilities. The poetic articulation of Creole, right down to its mode of appearance in the newspapers and periodicals, necessarily works within a world which perceives it as deviant from a standard. The perspective of historical poetics, which I understand to have as its core purpose the restoration of past poetic phenomenologies, compels us to contend with Creole qua dialect as it struggled to produce a self-sufficient poetic articulation. What I am hoping to trace in the project which this is a part of is a historical process by which Creole attained its own center of linguistic and poetic gravity. In the 1970s, Kamau Brathwaite came up with an ingenious way of conceptualizing the difference between a Creole poetic that accedes to the normativity of standard and one that has its own center of gravity. He differentiated between dialect and nation language. This is a qualitative distinction. So, for instance, John Figueroa's poem, Portrait of a Woman, may have an embedded persona who speaks Creole, but Brathwaite reckons its poetics to be working within a standard norm. It is a poem wet and sticky with dialect. It's nation language, sorry. It's trying to become nation language, but it's still wet and sticky with dialect. That is a kind of a Creole in a state of subjection to standard. For Brathwaite, Claude McKay's early Creole verse articulates as a dialect. It submits to the formal logic of standard English, something that he called pentameter, which is kind of like a code word for SE poetics, standard English poetics. McKay, Brathwaite claims, quote, did not let his language find its own parameters, which is the same thing as saying he did not let it find its own Creole poetics. The mere use of Creole in verse, thus, is not sufficient ground for it to be nation language. It must, quote, find its own parameters. So what I'm tracing in this paper and this project is the process by which Creole finds its own poetic parameters. I accept Brathwaite's premises, but I want to deploy his notion of nation language against his verdict on McKay. A historical poetics of McKay's Creole verse reveals a remarkably conscious probing of the limits of dialect poetics, one which produces a self-consciously exemplary nation language poem, The Liquid Negro Language of the South, a piece written as a direct riposte to debates over the legitimacy of Creole as a poetic medium. It's a code-switching lyric dialogue written pointedly in the pentameter. I'm going to kind of do the paper backwards. Instead of going through the debates and then coming to the poem, I want to start with some of the features of the poem and then look at the debates so you can see how it has responded to those debates. But you'll just notice this byline. It's not like I'm making this up. Dedicated, if they so allow, to the opponents of dialect poetry. So it's a conscious, very clear response to a series of debates that you are about to see on the clicker. So I've just transcribed it, so it's a little bit easier to read. So I'm just going to read. It's in standard English. It's a sort of lyric dialogue of a sort where someone is imagining the beloved and then imagining the beloved's voice. Please note that this is not code switching from standard English into me select, which I won't explain, Jamaican Creole. It's code switching from standard Jamaican English into Creole. It's very important. So it's not the case that we're dealing with two separate, a sort of British and a Jamaican language. We're dealing with two separate Jamaican languages. Soon shall I return, Leonie love, to meet you in the waiting fern-grown glen, at nightfall when countless eyes above gaze moodily down on the haunts of men. To hold your eyes with mine and from them draw that which for me makes this black night pure day. Your perfect love in which there is no flaw, and hear your voice melodiously say, I love you so, my own, I love you so. Do kiss me, sweeter love, and call me pet. Oh, I will love you through the year that go, and come, my darling, with undying breath. Oh, fold me tighter with your chocolate arm, like bird I put its little one to rest. Oh, let my heart for you be ever warm by resting sweetly on your beating breast. Now, I don't have the technical capacities to make firm pronouncements about this kind of material, and for reasons that I hope will become clear. It's actually not clear how one would read this, and I don't think we should make assumptions, certainly not anachronistic ones, based on how I, an Australian middle-class person, would read this kind of verse. But these are just some things which I've listed on the right, which I find possibly significant and which are just speculation. So one is that it's a code-switching dialogue that uses the pentameter to intervene pointedly in a debate about the suitability of Creole for printed verse. That I'm pretty confident of, that McKay had written some pentameter lines in Creole before, but he'd mostly, as everybody at the time, written ballads. So he's simultaneously here doing two things. He's showing, one, that he, as a Jamaican peasant, can write in standard Jamaican English, and he's also trying to demonstrate that the Creole is a medium which can have multiple metrical possibilities. It's not just a medium the ballad's not the only genre that can be used. And these are the more speculative comments. I think that there's an indication here that he's trying to find a rhythmic mode that can shift along the Creole continuum from standard into deeper and deeper varieties of Jamaican Creole. One is what I was talking to Meredith and Sean about this. I detected, and I'm talking to David as well, a sort of attempt at certain moment to create a kind of triplet feel. It's in pentameter, and of course pentameter can have a three-beat feel, but I think there are some indications, such as the use of moodily, and I love you so, Sisura, my own, I love you so, I love you so, my own, I love you so, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But it requires a much broader contextualization to be able to make that point. And also, there's the use of Sisura in the first line quite prominently. I think he's trying to intervene to stop a beating out sort of iambic pentameter standard English ear from immediately imposing a set of rhythms. So he's trying to produce a certain different articulation of the voice. But then those sisuras fade away as he gets into the rhythm. So I think he's just trying to build a rhythm that can encompass both standard Jamaican English and a miselecto Jamaican Creole. And this is part of a practice that I'm trying to develop bespoke for this project of cellular scansion. That is trying to work out units of poetic rhythms that work in different modes along the continuum. So not talking about metrical feet, but looking at the ways in which Caribbean versifiers tried to find different forms of rhythmic units to create patterning. So that's just some starting observations. Go back to that. The claim to which I'm building is that we should read the liquid Negro language of the South not as an exemplary poem. In fact, I think the ballads are much more interesting in some ways. It is an attempt, rather, to establish the conditions for the possibility of exemplarity. He is making a certain claim for Creole's poetic status, and accordingly attempting to institute the basis on which any given Creole poem could be considered to be exemplary. In a sense, this is a poem that wants to enable the poemness of his other Creole poems and the other Creole poems of other authors. It is an intervention into a debate about the limits of poetics in order that other poems might exist as poems. That's what I'm saying. For the opponents of dialect verse sought not to question the quality of one or other poem, but to annul the poetic status of a volume like McKay's Songs of Jamaica. Creole could not be a medium of poetry, therefore there was no such thing as a Creole poem. It matters, therefore, that McKay was exemplifying the capacity both to write pentameter Creole lines and also standard English ones. And, well, Creole lines that could be read in a pentametric way. Here we must introduce the terms that were typically used to describe dialect verse, most prominently doggerel. No great conceptual detour is necessary here. I just use doggerel to refer to verse that makes predictable use of generic and technical conventions to humorous effect, whether intended or not. For at least a century before McKay, there was a tradition in the Caribbean of usually whites writing humorous doggerel in the Creole voice, a kind of verse minstrelsy. The effect usually was deliberate, and at its worst, it played on an essentialist correlation between dialect's apparent brokenness and the supposed simple-mindedness of Negroes. The word itself does not appear, but the verse in these debates, but verse in this tradition tend to accentuate the rhythmic patterns of the ballad stanza in particular in order to emphasize the cognitive limitations of the Negro-speaking subject. One should not draw hasty conclusions, though, about racial identities. I've been learning that this tradition is complex and varied, and it is not at all easy to determine the racial identity of the writers involved, who were often anonymous. There is also an overlap with the Creole tradition of the trickster persona of Anansi, who plays on the expectations of his simplicity in order to outsmart his white masters. So you actually need to get inside the seeming simplicity of these voices. You can't just assume that there's a kind of racial essentialism going on. This strain is evident in Edward Caudle's series of verse columns, Creole verse columns in Barbados in the 1890s, columns that were reportedly read aloud with great pleasure in the island's black, white, and coloured communities. So I think there's actually an opportunity often to read this doggerel against the set of historical expectations that they engendered. And I think the Anansi tradition is really important, the trickster tradition. The line between poetry and doggerel is apparent in a series of poems written for the Jamaica time just before the young McKay came onto the scene. This series of seven poems was published under the title of, I won't go into that, Dialect Jingles, Dat Watless Duck. Now, the earliest, we got to think about what jingle means here. The earliest use of jingle in the now dominant commercial sense is listed in the OED as being 1930. So presumably, jingle here refers to the meaning of affected repetition of the same sound or a similar series of sounds, as in alliteration, rhyme, or assonance, any arrangement of words intended to have a pleasing or striking sound without regard to the sense. So this is jingle, which is in a sense playing on the novelty of the Creole, the sound of Jamaican Creole, for its own kind of pleasures. Like many serious poets both before and after him, McKay showed his willingness to engage in forms of versifying that play on the novelty of Creole, such as with the following Christmas poem. What a happy band are we, dancing round a Christmas tree. The old year is at its close, and we know naught boughten woes. We're as happy as could be, playing with the red goose rose. I mean, it's very hard, if you don't know who's writing, it's very hard to differentiate this from the sort of traditions and the many Creole ballads circulating at this time. So this could easily have appeared on a Caribbeana gift card. This alone should indicate that we are dealing with a provincial literary culture, Ivor, where limited opportunities and an enthusiasm for novelty made it difficult to adhere to one's aesthetic commitments. The generic boundaries are not at all clear, only a historical poetics attuned to the subtlety of Creole usage or lack thereof will be able to make distinctions and get inside the incipient intentions of the verse at this time. The difficulties only multiply when we consider that until the 1960s, Creole was almost entirely an oral language. In fact, these are often the examples that historical linguists use. The historical fluidities and evolutions of which are very hard to gauge. So it's actually, if you, as I have done, ask a contemporary Jamaican Creole speaker to read this poetry, and I've done some recording, people will trip up and go, I don't know. Oh. And often will fall into a kind of very nursery-like iambic declaration because they're not really sure of how it might have been articulated. And there's a sense that McKay's early verse is quite failed. Meredith, how much time do I have? Five minutes? Is that you being generous?
Well, we started late.
Okay. So I don't have any more paper to read out. I just want to go through the debate, so you can see, in a sense, what led to the liquid Negro language of the South. So McKay, it was like front page news. I'm not joking. It was front page news that someone was publishing a volume of dialect verse. And McKay won prizes. Every time a review was done of the volume, there was a notice in the Gleaner and the Jamaica Times saying someone's reviewed our great young Jamaican poet. There's a sense that he was playing to a certain form of Jamaican national pride at the time, a kind of very much within a circumscribed colonial environment. And there was no, in my reading through the archive, there was no whiff that anyone objected to McKay's success and the sense that his poem were the work of a potential young Jamaican Burns, until this letter by Dixon, who writes, "Sir, I noticed in today's Gleaner a poem in dialect by Mr. H.A. Howlett." So this is not McKay, but someone who, inspired by McKay's example, another young black poet, started writing dialect, ballad. Which is only one of the many appearing of late. I should not like to pass sentence on these attempts in toto, but I really feel when reading them that most of them could be summed up in the word rubbish. even you know, our young Burns has not done well. For certain it is that if he can write as well in dialect, he can do much better in pure English. And his language of pure English is both confronting and entirely prevalent at the time. So Walter Jekyll, who was a kind of mentor to Claude McKay, immediately weighed in and caused more damage in some ways, caused more harm than good in trying to argue for his younger acquaintance. People talk about, there's a very misleading biography of Claude McKay that makes out like Jekyll was this sort of, you know, very important mentor figure. And these exchanges, which don't feature in that biography, actually show that the biographer needed to do a bit more work. That they obviously weren't that close. So Jekyll replies and says, look, we got to support these young black poets, and then lists a set of criteria for why this is important material. I'm just going to highlight the things that are important for this historical poetics. So they have not the command of good English, which must be very good indeed, before it can be used in poetry. Therefore, in beginning to write, they are wise to confine themselves to their mother tongue. Those who begin by writing in dialect may end by writing in pure English. So this is what I'm going to call the stepping stone thesis, that dialect is a stepping stone to writing proper poetry in proper English, pure English. And then this is a little bit more promising as a kind of prosodic defense. So dialect has many, so I did this late, very late last night. Dialect has man poetic advantage. It introduces new rhymes. Moreover, the Jamaican dialect vowels have a beautiful quality. And then he cites a McKay poem. Pretty bad, though. Like, he just says, what could be prettier? You know, just a rhetorical question. There's better readings of McKay out there at the time. Mr. Howlett's poem, to which Mr. Dixon makes special reference, exemplifies most strikingly the above-mentioned power of dialect in the formation of new rhymes. In pure English, he would have been confined to three rhyming words in the last of the stanzas. Dialect gives him eight: bredder, wedder, togedder, tedder, redder, shedder, fedder, and edder. So then T.A. Mead, who we find out is probably a middle-class black man, weighs in. Mr. Dixon, evidently a man of some learning, I love the little slight evidently, has so far allowed his knowledge of English prosody and metre to exceed his wisdom as to ruthlessly condemn the successful efforts of Mr. Claude McKay and other talent Jamaicans. This gentleman's criticism argues that, because I speak English and admire English masterpieces, I must publicly condemn masterpieces written in any other language besides the one above mentioned. How ridiculous! So in a sense, he's saying there are two languages here. Not surprising, someone who probably speaks both Creole and standard Jamaican English. And then Dixon responds, a man of Mr. Jekyll's intelligence ought to realize that our mother tongue is the English language. The African language died with the imported Africans. And that's kind of at the bottom of what's going on here, the total misrecognition of the African element in Jamaican Creole. The language of the unlearned mass of our people is nothing less nor more than broken English. He says, I have abused, this is now to C.A. Mead, he says, I have abused the talent of these writers. This is untrue. I rather gave them credit for their talent, but they're using bad material. Fancy Mr. Jekyll telling you to keep your nigger tongue, Mr. Mead. How do you like that? It's getting pretty intense. And then Jekyll hopelessly comes back into the thing and says, in Constant Ballad, there is already one short poem in faultless English, and since the publication of that book, he has taken to writing idiomatically both in prose and verse. This he could not have done at first. So he's trying to maintain his stepping stone thesis that somehow dialect has allowed McKay to become a versifier in English. In his mother tongue, his thoughts flowed straight from brain to paper. So he is a kind of nativist ideology in his notion that McKay, when he was working in Creole, just immediately could write this verse, and that enabled him to become conscious of versification. And okay, we're wrapping up. This is a second last one. So Bunbury comes in and says, we should judge it on poetical ground. This is another writer. But then he says, Jamaican Creole is an impracticable medium and that it's a waste of time and talent to attempt using it for poetical purposes, with a lot of racist stuff afterwards. It's not exactly broken English. It resembles rather English that has been reduced to fragments by an explosion, and that people were trying to put together again, maimed though they might be. Sorry for all the typos. I wasn't able to look over this morning. And then look at this, you know, the Gleaner, you know, you've got to really get inside the archive at this time. The Gleaner says, Claude McKay defends our dialect poetry, since they're editorializing very much on McKay's side. McKay then makes a series of points in this article. In a way, I don't want to dwell on it because I don't have any time. But he rejects the stepping stone thesis as well as the assumptions about the versifiability of Jamaican Creole. But the point being that he then does this a week later. So when he's doing his code-switching poem, he's trying to do in the very material of verse that which he has argued. So that's why I'm saying this is an exemplary poem which is trying to enable the poemness of his other poem, to establish their credentials as things that could be read at poem. The other thing I want to say is that there is a great moment in an early review of the Songs of Jamaica that does attend to its metrical possibilities in Jamaican Creole, particularly the way in which it notices the way in which along would be said, the quantitative qualities of along, marching along, quietities, that this fits in a kind of trucky meter, but I'm not going to dwell on that. Thank you very much.